I have to go upstairs and record something again, so...
Quiet.
Do not...
smash anything.
And do not disturb.
Do not disturb.
Do not come into your room.
You're listening to Pandemic, a podcast from RTE News and Current Affairs on the COVID-19 crisis. I'm Colm O'Mungine, and each week I'll be talking to RTE's correspondents, reporters and others to bring you news, updates and analysis you can trust. We can guarantee you a high quality of information. Sound quality, on the other hand, might vary somewhat. The correspondents and I will be recording this in many cases on mobile devices from home, so please do bear with us. It's Thursday the 6th of August, and at the time of recording this podcast in the evening, the number of infections globally, according to the Johns Hopkins University tracker, is approaching 19 million. The death toll stands at around 709,000. Now, listener, as you know, we're back from a two-week break, and since our last episode on July 16th, infections globally have risen by 5 million, and around 125,000 more people have died with COVID-19. In Ireland, five more deaths have been reported today, bringing total fatalities here to 1,768. That's 19 since our last episode. Later in this episode, we'll be hearing about South Korea's quarantine regime from an Irish man who's been through it. He's now living in Seoul, and he's going to give us an insight into the intensive management of coronavirus in that country. But first, in a week when we learned once again that Phase 4 would be delayed, let's get the latest on this evening's NPHET briefing with our correspondent Orla O'Donnell. How are you, Orla?
I'm fine, thanks, Colm.
Yeah, a bit of a worry from what I heard from the briefing this evening that you were in attending about the Midlands. We'll get to that in due course. But something else that's still doing the rounds today, more in the political sphere, it has to be said, and demands that the evidence that NPHET have for advising that the pub should stay closed, that was raised again at the press conference. There isn't going to be any movement on it.
Yes, well, actually, Dr. Ronald Lynn was almost snorted contemptuously when that was raised again. He basically said, you know, what are you talking about? You just put pubs and transmission of COVID-19 into Google and you get, all the instances around the world where the reopening of pubs or where pubs have been linked to outbreaks or clusters of COVID-19. So he was absolutely not for budging on that and was almost dismissive of these arguments that the evidence should be produced. He's basically saying the evidence is there for anybody who wants to see it. It stands to reason that when people are in a place where there's lots of alcohol, where people might lose their inhibitions as time goes on, it would be harder to maintain social distancing. And with the current uptick in cases around the country, they don't really want that to happen.
Their big fear is community transmission, and they're relatively, I wouldn't say happy, but they're not overly worried about the rate of community transition at the moment. There is still concern there, but they also laid out a number of other areas. Will you run us through that?
Yes, they are concerned. At the moment, they say the R number is at 1.8, which is quite high, and they're very concerned about that. But Professor Philip Nolan said they weren't seeing very much community transmission. That's where there are cases, unexplained cases in the community, and that's their real worry. They are saying that the cases at the moment are concentrated in these clusters and outbreaks, and they've had fewer than 10 cases a day where there's been community transmission. But Professor Nolan said as well that there was a very large reservoir of disease in these outbreaks, and he was basically saying we'd be very lucky, we'd be very fortunate indeed if it stayed in those reservoirs, if it didn't spread through the communities. He said there was a real risk, a very severe risk, that the disease could spread more widely, and we've heard about how it has increased already. We heard about a sharp increase, a clear increase, a significant upsurge. The fact that the average number of cases per day has more than doubled to 53 per day, and that hospital admissions have, although they're not going up dramatically, they have stopped declining. So there's a real worry at the moment, and I suppose a hope that the community transmission won't get out of control.
And the one, well, and there were a number of counties that were mentioned. I'm sitting in one of them, Kildare, and Laois and Offaly also mentioned. So why should I be worried, Orla?
Yes, it was a bit of a kind of a shocking moment in the press briefing where just before they took questions, Dr. Ronald Lynn said that he wanted to address Kildare, Leash and Offaly in particular. And he said there had been 226 cases in the past 14 days in these three counties, more almost half of all cases in Ireland over that period. He said GPs in those counties had been written to, and he said he was advising everyone in those counties to pay particular attention to new symptoms, to contact their GP immediately, double down on public health measures. Over 70s, they were strongly recommending people over 70 and people who are medically vulnerable to take extra care, to limit the number of people they speak to, not to go into crowded settings, to wear face coverings. And they are really, they are very concerned. They are concerned in particular about four meat factories in these counties and direct provision centres associated with them, or where some of the workers might live. Now, they say that three direct provision centres have been causing concern, but they do feel they have the situation under control in those direct provision centres. But the meat factories, they are really worried about. And there was a statement from one of those meat factories this evening that would cause concern to anybody who saw it. Basically, O'Brien Fine Foods in Timahoo in County Kildare, saying that they had 80 positive cases. They began with three. They had three since May. They had been doing everything right. They sought advice from the HSC. And they went, they decided to test everybody, and they suddenly went from three cases to 80 cases. And they said, even more worryingly, there was a high level of asymptomatic infectivity in relation to those cases. So a lot of these cases are people who have absolutely no symptoms whatsoever. And there are 42 more people from associated with this factory who are waiting test results. Dr. Glynn said that they tomorrow are expecting around 60 more cases, which are going to come into tomorrow's total of new cases from those three counties. And he said they need to understand where those cases have come from. I suppose they want to, they're really, really worried that these cases could spread into the wider community, that they will be, no longer be contained in outbreaks.
They said, you mentioned direct provision centres there, they said they don't want to rush into outlining what's going to be done in terms of testing there. They'll mention that on in the next couple of weeks. But they did say they are taking precautions with regard to older people and healthcare workers in direct provision.
Yes, they want them to self-isolate, and they want to move them into the isolation facility in City West in Dublin. And they are intending to mass, to have regular retesting of residents in direct provision centres. And they are, although they don't have a timescale for that yet, they are hoping to do that in the next couple of weeks or so. Now, I mean, one slight positive note from Dr. Glynn was that he said they were expecting to get these kind of clusters. He said it's an entirely normal part of dealing with the pandemic. It won't be the last time he's talking about clusters like this. He said they have been monitoring it very closely over the last 10 days. And there was a need, he said, to protect the wider community, but they were watching it and have been expecting something like this.
And the age range, they seem to be trying to strike a balance between, on the one hand, not trying to alienate younger people from the message by coming out and condemning them, but at the same time, they're saying, look, there's a particular concern there, and the detection also in children of workers. So it's still a particular area of concern.
Yes, well, I think the doctor, Professor Nolan, mentioned that there have been some cases in children, but he said there have been cases in family settings. I think that's really what he was referring to there. They've launched a communications campaign today, the Department of Health and the HSC, beginning with posters, very colourful posters around the country, trying to focus on young people, I suppose, and trying to get them to adhere to the public health advice and trying to reinforce those public health messages. We've heard the minister in recent days thanking young people for what they've done so far and recognising how difficult it has been for them. But they really want young people to try and stick to the message. They're saying that, you know, there have been small minorities of people who are not abiding by the public health regulations and not abiding by social distancing. And Professor Nolan said that a house party, for example, was the perfect situation in which to allow the spread of COVID-19 from an outbreak into the wider community.
You were having a look at some of the hospital bed figures, particularly acute or critical care beds, also known as, I suppose, intensive care unit beds.
Yes, although they don't seem at the moment to be concerned. What they said about hospitals was that the numbers are not rising, but they did say that admissions have stopped declining, which is, I suppose, slightly worrying. In terms of the figures that we had last night, there were 9 confirmed cases in 8 hospitals around the country. 6 were in ICU. And then the previous there were 97 suspected cases, and 14 of those were in intensive care, 14 suspected cases of COVID-19. Now, that's up from 8 the previous day, which was a little bit of a worry, but the health officials today at the briefing did not seem to be too concerned about that. There's also 285 critical care beds in the country's hospitals occupied at the moment, and just 39 available. And there are 263 general beds available across the hospital. So that seems like quite a small number. And we did ask Dr. Colm Henry, the Chief Clinical Officer of the HSC, about that, whether or not the hospital service was prepared for another wave of COVID-19, whether they would have the beds available for people if things did get out of control, if community transmission became more widespread. And he was making the point that a lot of the beds at the moment are taken up by people who are having procedures that they maybe they couldn't have when the pandemic was raging at its height, and that I suppose if they needed to free up those beds again, they would make some efforts to do so. At that stage, actually, Professor Philip Nolan came in with quite a strong statement. He really wanted to say it, and he said there was absolutely no excuse for going back to uncontrolled community transmission in a manner that would threaten our health services. He said, we know what to do now. We didn't know in March, but we do know how to stop the transmission of this disease now. He said everybody had to take personal responsibility. There was no excuse for it to happen. And Dr. Dinn, at another point in the press conference, said they weren't going to let uncontrolled community transmission happen.
Finally then, Orla, the Health Information and Quality Authority, I suppose that watchdog of the health service, had a couple of reports they were asked to do out this week. One was on immunity and the other one was on temperature screening and health officials screening at airports. What was in that?
Yes, they just put together two summaries of the available evidence, I suppose, to support the National Public Health Emergency Team. Firstly, dealing with temperature screening or non-contact thermal screening and whether this could be used to identify cases of COVID-19. We're all probably used to being screened at certain places now, perhaps at dentists' surgeries or on the way into different congregated settings. But the studies examined by HICWA in particular were conducted in the context of airports, points of entry for countries. So it's not clear how much relevance they would have, for example, if it was decided they might be needed in schools. But HICWA found from studying all the available evidence that these this mass screening, this temperature screening, is not effective in identifying infectious individuals or limiting the spread of the disease. It says detection rates were consistently low across the studies. And I suppose that's because so many people with COVID-19 seem to be asymptomatic, or because at the point at which they were screened, they hadn't developed a temperature, or maybe a temperature was not one of the symptoms that they had. Secondly, they were looking at the immune response. So they again studied all the available evidence in relation to the immune response to COVID-19. Probably unsurprisingly, they found that it remains unclear whether there is any long-term immunity to the virus that causes COVID-19. They found that an antibody specific to the virus was detected in almost all people up to 3 months after being infected, and over 90% of patients developed a neutralizing antibody response. But there are some studies that show that it may be possible to become reinfected, so that is a worry. So really, there's nothing definitive on that at the moment. HICWA are going to continue to monitor that and update the report as needs be.
All right, thanks a million, Orla. Safe home.
Thanks.
Now, I will go over these numbers again in the course of this next interview, but they really are remarkable. Korea's population is over 51 million. That's over 10 times that of Ireland. It recorded its first case of COVID-19 on January 20th, and since then, 14,500 infections have been recorded, just over half of Ireland's number of infections. But at 302, its death rate is less than one-sixth of Ireland's. Masks, intensive testing, and a particularly intense regime of isolation and quarantining have all been used. All the while, much of the country's economic life has remained open. Now, it has been affected by a downturn in tourism and the overall drop in the global economy. But what's it like to live with the prevention measures I mentioned earlier? I've been asking Donal O'Criadon, who spoke to me from the heart of Seoul. All right, Donal, how are you?
I'm very good, Colm. Thank you for talking to me.
Okay, well, we're having this conversation on the basis that you had heard the podcast, and I think maybe the episode on Taiwan you had heard, but you're in South Korea. So where are you originally from, and how do you find yourself in Seoul?
I'm originally from County Clare, and I've just finished university and was keen on seeing some more of the world, and for various reasons chose South Korea. And my part of that was because my partner is Korean, and having just coming to the end of university, And seeing countries harden their borders, I turned to her and asked, was South Korea doable? And she nodded and decided, let's do it. So that is how I found myself. That's the short version of how I found myself in Seoul.
Okay, so at the moment, we'll get into where you are at the moment, sitting there still in a celebratory mode in an Arsenal jersey, I can see over the video call. My eldest son is a Chelsea fan, so he's in less celebratory mode at the moment. So what date did you leave Ireland? I mean, how was Ireland when you left it? And then landing in Seoul, how different was it?
I left Ireland on May 17th or 18th. Ireland, at that point, was just about 8 weeks into lockdown, was about to do the first phase lifting of restrictions. So, I mean, through those 8 weeks, I was sitting in a flat in Dublin, not doing a whole lot, just finishing off university. So coming to Korea, doing the 2 week quarantine, once I'd done that and came out into life in Korea, it was as if life had begun again. Ireland at the time had just, I think for the day I left for the first time, they'd been under 100 cases since March. So things were actually looking up in Ireland when I left. But as I say, I'd just come through 8 weeks of lockdown. So I was still, it was a relief to get away and into a country that was operating.
All right, well, let's have a look at South Korea's record. Population, 51 million, so more than 10 times Ireland's population. It's had 14,500 confirmed cases and 302 deaths. It's a pretty good record. So based on your experience, when you landed there, what's the quarantine like? Because in Ireland, the quarantine at the moment is people land, they fill out a form. There may or may not be a checkup call afterwards. From what you were outlining in your email to me, there's not much left to chance in South Korean quarantine.
No, it is a very well-oiled machine. As soon as you land, once you come out of the gangway, there's a check, temperatures are taken, your picture's taken, you have to download a self-quarantine app into which you enter your phone number and the address at which you will be quarantining. You will be brought to your house via public transport, designated only for international arrivals. So there's a train with carriages specifically for people coming from abroad, and they will get you to your nearest train station or bus terminal. And from there, public officials, civil servants will drive you, in our case, in the back of an old ambulance to our place of quarantine, stopping off for a COVID test along the way. In the train station, getting from the airport to the train station, there are many army conscripts and civil servants making sure that no one escapes. And you're essentially herded from place to place. If you tried, it would be very difficult to get out. So they really do not, it's all set up to make sure that everyone gets from arrivals to quarantine without anyone slipping through the cracks. And once you're in quarantine, there are follow-up calls almost every day. Each person is assigned a minder who will call you every day. You have to self-diagnose. The quarantine app I just mentioned, you are given thermometers at the hospital when you're tested. Every day, twice, you must take your temperature, record any symptoms that you might have, record symptoms that you don't have. And you will be asked those questions again by your minder when they call you. The university at which I'm studying Korean at the moment would ring me every couple of days to remind me to self-diagnose twice a day and was I having any symptoms. So it really is as tight as you can reasonably make it.
Right. And that image of, you know, conscripts in the army helping out to get people onto buses and make sure they don't slip through the net. I mean, how hands-off or hands-on is that? Is there quite an intimidating atmosphere when you land from another country, or is it all handled cordially enough? How does that feel?
It is fairly cordial. Obviously, coming from Ireland, where I have almost no interaction with soldiers, it is jarring just to see soldiers in general, but they are very cooperative because they're there to help. They're there both to protect the country, but also to help you get through immigration and into quarantine. My Korean was extremely broken when I got there, so that caused a few issues and I think frustrated one or two of them. But it is, they are there to help you, and that is very clear.
Right. Now, so it's the army in a kind of a civil defence mode, as opposed to standing there like a paramilitary police force trying to intimidate you onto the public transport.
Exactly, that's it. Because it's very resource intensive, but they have this huge stock of people they can use to make the process work. So they really are, like you say, civil defence. They're there to help both sides.
So you were going to an apartment of your own where you were going to be living, were you, as opposed to going to one of these hotels where you remain under CCTV surveillance in the corridors and the like, which I've been reading about in preparation for this.
Right. I was quarantining with my partner in her family home. We had to boot her mother out for the 2 weeks and she had to stay somewhere else. The two of us stayed in that apartment. There are multiple what are called consent to quarantine forms that you have to sign at the embassy saying, here's where I want to quarantine. If I'm on a long-term visa, I will quarantine here. And if it is not satisfactory, I agree to be quarantined at a government facility at my own expense. So from the off, there's no messing about.
Right.
You need a suitable place. And if not, they will pick you up and take you to a government facility. And in fact, my phone number did not work. The self-quarantine app, when I downloaded it, the SIM card I was using did not actually work. And it was just by chance that my partner, she was going through immigration for Korean nationals. She realized that she had a working SIM card and had to scramble to where I was. Had she not had that quick realization, I may well have found myself in a government quarantine facility at my own expense, because right. If they don't have a working phone number, that is what they will do.
Right. It's about 75 quid a night, I think, and you have to stay in your room. And the corridors are CCTV monitored. It's pretty heavy.
I've been certainly reading about it from other international arrivals, and I'm very glad to have avoided it.
Right. Okay. The fines for breaching your quarantine are also pretty onerous. I've read a year in prison and over 7,000 euros of a fine.
Yes, that was... The amount seems to change. There's the threat of deportation. So before you can even get to an immigration officer at the airport, you have to sign no end of forms, and a lot of them very repetitive, but they were very clear that violations can be dealt with by deportation. Now, I imagine that's for repeat offenders, but certainly at a minimum, even a one-time breach is pretty serious. They do not take any chances here.
All right. Well, I mean, you're blessed with a kind of a first person insight into Korea, obviously, but you're also seeing it through the eyes of a Korean family. And what they've been lauded for, I suppose, is that they learned from their experience with SARS and MERS, two previous epidemics, and they really beefed up their health services. They had contact tracing in place for this situation. They were conducting up to about, I think, 20,000 tests a day, but also there was high compliance already for various reasons with mask wearing.
Yes, mask wearing is actually fashionable anyway. A lot of people just wear masks anyway, but there is certainly a respect for authority. It's not blind obedience, but a respect for the idea that, hey, this is good for everyone, so let's do it. And you're right, MERS, they started off, when the MERS outbreak came first, there was very little information given to the public on where patients were, and there was a bit of a backlash to that. So the government decided, right, you want to know everything? We'll be fully transparent. We'll tell you everything about where the patients are with MERS and how they were trying to deal with it. So there was that, first of all, an infrastructure, but secondly, people were, I opened the idea that if they tested positive, that their information, almost everything but their name, could be made public, you know, where they work, a brief description, age, and where they regularly go, so that contact tracing is very easy. So for example, I get emergency alerts. If there's a confirmed case in my area, I get an alert to my phone, and if I think it looks relevant to me, yet there's a blog with further details about who the case is. The idea being that if I know that person, I will recognize their profile. So everything is very transparent. And that is another part of the legacy of MERS that has enabled South Korea to deal with this very well.
Right. Let's get back to that Arsenal jersey you're wearing there. We had the FA Cup over the weekend. Did you get to watch it in a bar? Or you're living, as you said, in central Seoul. So what's the social life there like, if any, for a hardworking student of Korean who may or may not get out at all for a social life?
The social life is pretty... Things are pretty normal. So life continues... But for the fact that masks are almost 100% worn outdoors, it's very rare to see someone without one. Life is pretty normal. Pubs are open. Nightclubs are... I haven't visited any yet, but for the most part, pubs and nightclubs are open. They were closed temporarily after an outbreak in May, but I think they're open again. Life is pretty normal, but you do often have to sign your name and give a phone number when you enter places, particularly if that place has been in the news for having had a COVID case. But other than that, life's pretty normal. As for the match, I'm delighted to talk about it. I didn't actually get to watch it. It was on at 2 in the morning. So I decided I'm going to sleep because I wasn't particularly optimistic. But because that's what I've been doing for the last few weeks since sports resumed. It's a relief to go to bed and not have to endure my team's recent performances and just get up in the morning and see what happens. So I did get to watch it back.
Okay, all right. So a recorded version of it. What's from listening to your partner's Korean family and talking to them, has life changed at all for them, or are things proceeding, as you've outlined there, pretty remarkably as normal, given that they are in China's near abroad, the source of the original outbreak? They seem to have had a very, I suppose I wouldn't say it a fortunate escape, but a very competent plan in place that has insulated them from the very worst effects.
Yes, the initial outbreak, there's been one major outbreak really in Korea, and that was much of it stemmed from one person, and that might have made it easier to deal with that initial outbreak because it was one community. But as I say, life has mostly continued, and as for my partner's family, they're in a city that has yet to even have one confirmed case. So life there, masks there are not as common as in Seoul. They're very much continuing as normal.
So and there hasn't been a case in the city?
No, in their city, of what they call a town, but what I'd call a city of over 100,000 people, they have yet to have a confirmed case. But you can, that was possibly because that first outbreak was stemmed from just one community. When we finished quarantine in Tongyeong, we went to Seoul to find a place to live because that's where we were going to move. But we couldn't move into our house straight away, so we were going to go back to Tongyeong. But when we got off the bus, we were screened, temperatures taken, and the bus was cleaned with someone with what looked like a fertilizer can on their back. And everything, even city to city, is pretty tight. So that is perhaps how it is, just very rigid, and as little as possible is left to chance.
Finally then, you're studying Korean where you are at the moment. How are classes conducted? What's education like? Is it all via Zoom calls, or is there any classroom face-to-face time?
Schools in Korea were closed in February anyway when the outbreak came here, but they did not they returned mostly online, and they were the main thing that actually shut down. Most workplaces stayed open through the worst of the outbreak in Korea. Sports events and so on were banned, large concerts, large gatherings. But schools are the one daily life thing that did actually shut down. But most schools have reopened pretty tentatively. So a couple, I know in Seoul, just reading about it on the news, did shut down again if there was a confirmed case, just for a few days, and until almost everyone at school was tested, and then those that could were brought back. But my university is running everything online, just in the language school. Most other regular students are doing at least partial face-to-face learning. Now, I don't know why they have picked the Korean Language Institute. It might be because we are all recently arrived foreigners, but that we're running online. Most other things are at least partially face-to-face, and most schools seem to be running as normal now.
Okay, well, hopefully that'll be the case in this country when educational institutions return in September. But Donal, thanks very much for talking to us.
Thank you, Colin.
All the best for your studies.
Thank you.
And that's all for this episode of Pandemic. We're back next week with more. In the meantime, do get in contact with suggestions or questions by email to colm.omongain@rte.ie. That's colm.omongain@rte.ie. Or you can contact me on Twitter @colmomongain. Do subscribe through your usual podcast platform to get this podcast regularly. Reviews are welcome. Nice reviews are even more welcome. Thanks for listening.